Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Pearlman. My guest is poet, storyteller, and performer Margot Farrington. Farrington is author of three poetry collections, including Flares and Fathoms from Bright Hill Press, and her most recent, which she'll be reading from and discussing with us, is called Scanning for Tigers, which came out this year from Free Scholar Press. Farrington has performed in the U.S., France, the U.K., and the Netherlands, and she is the founder and program director of Writers at the Erie, which she started this year and is in Brooklyn, New York. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, I want to ask you, you describe yourself as someone who fell for words as soon as you could speak. So tell us about that. You began very verbal when you were a kid, huh?
Well, I had a very articulate and eloquent mother, and I had a father who loved to tell stories. So that was probably a very good launch pad for a child who was shy but had a lot of inner life going. So yes, I was quickly, I have no story to say that I began talking quickly as a child, but I began writing early on and writing poetry and writing my own little stories and singing songs the way children do. It's that wonderful free time before you begin to be a critic of yourself.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say a lot of people talk about how that censor shows up. Now, do you remember when you discovered poetry in a serious manner? I mean, you were writing all along, but when you decided it was really going to be the way you pronounce yourself to the world?
You know, that is an odd thing because there are many people who can say it was this moment or that moment or I knew then. And my development was a very strange, long, winding, with many asides, I think. Mm-hmm. And so, no, I can't find that moment where I said to myself, well, I must be a poet then. My early life, once I had left high school, was around theater. I actually left New Jersey and I went to New York, close by, but a quantum leap culturally.
Oh, yeah.
And I studied at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. And so I really was taken over by theater for a long time. And I worked in theater professionally. And at some point, I wasn't making a great go of it. Just about the time I got my equity card and probably could have done better, I turned back to poetry. Uh-huh. Quite decisively.
Well, you describe yourself as a storyteller and performer, and the storytelling comes through in the poems. So in some ways, did you translate some of these other professions that you thought you might pursue into writing poetry and turning it into storytelling?
Well, certainly theater is a tribal art, and so is poetry. And so there's that immediate connection there. And I was still very much performance-oriented, and actually for many years, more really than about the page and about publishing. Mm-hmm. And then I began storytelling also. So those two things are braided together.
Yeah, I can tell by your
and
work.
And that's a tandem path that I have never given up.
Yeah, yeah. I can see that in the poetry. It's a storytelling.
I think that if you have a fragment of a story, it's always tempting. It's good fodder for a poem. You can use one sentence of it, or you can attempt to tell the entire story, compressing it into a poem, which is sometimes a daunting challenge. Mm-hmm. There's one poem in this book that I tried for years to compress into a poem that really was a story, and it was one that happened to be taken from my own life experience, whereas there are many others that are not.
Yeah. Poetry, good poetry is a real challenge because you have to distill the language. You have to be very careful with the words. It's not a narrative, so you don't have too much room for error.
No. And hitting the nail on the head every day with language is a killer.
Well, let's talk about the new collection, Scanning for Tigers. It's a great collection. I absolutely loved it. Now you describe the book as about otherness and finding the strange within the ordinary. Talk to us about that. Was it a whole piece when you were writing it, or did it just come together? You looked at the poems and said, oh my gosh, this is a whole collection.
The collection came together slowly. And actually, it didn't assume that title until very close to the end. And yet that that poem is perhaps a marvelous example of what could be, in a way, a story, something that was snatched from an anecdote that my brother told me. It was his optometrist who said to him, "Eyes were never meant to read, but to scan for tigers."
I love that.
And I just, as soon as I heard it, it seized me, and I thought, oh, I feel a poem coming on.
Yeah, well, speaking of which, I do want to have you read that poem, the title poem, Scanning for Tigers. Do you want to elaborate a little bit more on what it's about, or would you like to read it first and then?
Well, I'd just like to say, regarding the optometrist's remark, that was interesting. He was saying, we were not meant to read as a species. And what he meant about scanning for tigers was that the healthiest environment for the eye is an eye that's always changing perspective. It's always changing distance perspective. So you look far away and you were looking for tigers, so tigers didn't get you, or whatever else might be out there to get you. But it was always a near and far thing. And now life with a computer brings you close up. And it's an eye destroyer.
Yeah, and people are losing perspective, too, in regard to where they even are in the world in some ways.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's have you read Scanning for Tigers, since we've been talking about it. It's really a fascinating poem.
Scanning for Tigers. The problem, the optometrist said, lies with print. Eyes were never meant to read, but to scan for tigers. To scan for tigers at a distance. Shift to a close-up of one arm, where a fallen insect uncurls, walks among hairs. Back again to distant, alert for stripes among the foliage, mindful of shadow among the shadows, conspiracies of light. The eyes, he said, were meant for roaming. The eyes were meant for wildness. Print in its ant parade tyrannizes. You can never look at a book the way you look at a woman. The woman and the tiger share a sinuous flow that lets the eyes slip by even as they behold. No grasping ever with the woman or the tiger, though each may imprint upon the retina a memory that devours. At this juncture of history, he said, rare to see the tiger anywhere, but women... well, ambush awaits in many a place. So which is most dangerous? Books also excite and inflame, banned and burned, and come to think of it, some women burned too. Blake's tiger ignited him. Every hunter burns. So we're on fire, he said lastly, from all we see. Books and men and women turn to ashes in the end. But the tiger remains an ember.
I love it. That's great. I love that poem. It's incredibly dramatic, too. And you tie this in with the fact that tigers and humans are under siege, too, in regard to survival.
Yes,
what were you thinking in those terms, too?
Yes. I could say, actually, about this whole collection that there are many poems that come out of my rage and consternation for what is happening to the planet. And then I have to take that seething broil and find a way to make a poem that examines why these things happen and possibly where we might go with it, or at least to say, hey, pay attention, look what's happening.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I think the poet's primary job is to be a witness and on occasion a prophet and say, here's what we're doing, and take heed.
And I want you to look, but I'm not going to throw it in your face. I'm going to use art to show you.
And art is that fiercest mirror of all to show you what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you've said that you also understand the power of silence. You know, silence is used in storytelling, and it's used in theater. To tell us how you use that in poetry.
Oh, I'd like to preface it by saying I was given a gift, and the gift came to me from a man who was my mime teacher at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. Mm. His name was Claude Kipnis. He was a French mime very fine, rather famous in his day. And it was learning mime that showed me the tremendous power that silence has. And so I never now think of a poem as language only. I think of it as language and silence and how they have to have equal weight. And if you don't give a poem its proper silences, then you're actually eroding some of its meaning. And of course, on the page, the silence is where the white space is. So you think about that as a poet when you write. But when you read, you have to allow those silences also, because it's a lot for people to absorb. And you want to give them the time. You want to give people time to feel their feelings. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're just hurrying them on.
Yeah, that's why it's so important to hear poetry spoken, as far as I'm concerned, so that the writer of intention is showing you the silences as well as the rich language and the communication. It's really interesting.
Exactly. And I also discovered when I was teaching that students who despaired of understanding a poem on the page that they had labored over at home, the first thing that we always did in class was I told them, I never allowed them to look at the poem, but I said, I'm going to read it to you now, so turn your book face down or turn that piece of paper over and just listen. And you would see the lights go on. You would see the faces light up with comprehension.
Uh-huh.
So they'd stumbled over My Last Duchess, but then when it was read, they got it immediately. And then we just launch into talking about it.
It's in our genes to hear stories from each other, it seems to me. And maybe people are intimidated by the page because it's more scholarly, maybe, in their minds. But
I think so, and I think also they're intimidated by some kind of hanging overall expectation, which has to do with how am I supposed to understand this? What is the proper way?
Yeah.
And that is a huge inhibitor. It feels, especially to people who have not had yet very much exposure, first of all, that it's an ivory tower art, right?
So
in a way, it's already been barred to them. And then secondly, that there's some high critic's expectation in an ether over them, so that if they don't get it, the bolt will come down and they'll be electrocuted.
Margot, I want to have you read another poem from Scanning the Talkers. This one's called Dusting with the Cat, and I found this quite interesting. It felt like a theater piece to me.
Okay, here we go. Dusting with the Cat. Her sinewy self, her mood, allows us our game. I hold her loosely round the ribs just back of the forelegs. We trace figure eights, and each begets another. Her purring revs, spun by turns into a vocal gleam. She doesn't care that she's a rag, the dust has her. We're locked in the luster of movement, building layers like a pearl. We're drunk on the wine of motion a certain speed achieves. What speed, I cannot say, though the fluent cat does, her song spliced with pauses where the orbits intersect. We're burnishing our years into the surface of my desk, her proverbial nine, my uncertain number. But a swinging cat cares not for count, living for sensation, and a wild woman always believes she has more time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Margot Farrington. We're talking about her newest collection of poetry called Scanning for Tigers. Now tell me, are you a writer that's constantly jotting down ideas and thoughts as you wander through your days? Or are you somebody who has to map out time in a quiet little room and just write at a certain moment?
I'm a wanderer, and I do find that a lot of what comes to me just as I'm walking or working or in some completely ordinary moment where I may have paused at a street intersection, struck by a street sign that said Delirium Cafe, and said, well, oh, there's one for me, the Delirium Cafe.
So you're not somebody who disciplines yourself saying every every morning between 7 and 9, I have to sit and write.
I do try to discipline mm-hmm. myself. And the morning is my best time, and I try for 4 hours.
Mm.
And after 4 hours, I cannot do any more. And then afternoons, I find I usually can't really make a poem, but I can successfully revise. Some days, yes, and some days, no, because, of course, as it goes along, you have those golden days that are marvelous. You must know this yourself as a writer mm-hmm. and as a poet. And then there are those terrible days where you struggle, where it seems like you're just treading in molasses and you just can't.
Yeah, yeah, and you really want to, too. Because I mean, life feels better when I've got poems being written.
It does.
Yeah, it does.
Actually, you've said a wonderful thing, which makes me want to say that I have pretty much come to living my life through symbols and metaphor. There is a marvelous book called The Dictionary of Symbols, and I am besotted with that book, and it's a lot of fun to read, and it makes life very rich when you see all the different cultures and you see what, say, a swan symbolizes or a color or a cloud. And then you are carrying all of this wonderful richness around with you.
The magic of ordinary things, I would call it. Yeah, that's really interesting. You mentioned that at first when you were writing poetry, you didn't think about publishing. Now that you are publishing, do you think you're writing differently? Are you writing less just for the voice, or do you want more deliberately for people who have to read it on their own?
No, I think that hasn't changed. I have hoped and I have striven to keep extremely high standards for whatever I did. And I think I was helped a lot by my work in theater regarding that, because theater, you've got to show up on time and you go on stage and then you have to do in front of a live audience and you have to try to do it the best you can.
Yeah, and the main thing also besides showing up is being prepared.
Prepared, yes.
Yeah.
And then prepared so well that you can just let go and fly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the most key thing about it, that you've done your work so steadily and so earnestly that once you step on stage, you can soar.
Yeah, and be creative without worrying about the logistics. Now, you say you love myth and folk tales. Did that start in childhood, too? I know it informs a lot of the poetry in this book, that's for sure.
I think it did, and also I had a grandmother who was a good storyteller, and she would sit at the table and light up yet another of her unfiltered Camel cigarettes with a cup of coffee in front of her, and she would hold forth. Her name was Ruth, and actually she does appear in the poem, a poem called Fragment. That was a story I wanted to save in a poem. It was her story of when she was a young woman, she had a mare named Maud, and she would ride Maud. And on occasion, Maud would take it into her head to run away with Ruth. And they were both willful, extremely willful. So the willful horse and the willful woman, who really didn't give a damn what anyone thought.
Uh-huh.
She divorced when divorce was a stigma, and she lived with a man in a very small town at a time when you just didn't do that.
Wow, great role model. I love it.
I thought I must save this story somehow. And so that poem was for her.
Wow. Yeah.
Save her story.
That's so nice to be able to save people's tales in that way, too. Okay, I want to have you read another from Scanning for Tigers. This one's called Bamboo Grove, Huntington Garden, California. This encompasses myth and travel and all the themes that you're interested in.
It mentions the poem Issa, and there's a quote of Issa's within it. And I just want to say that if one goes to this garden in the Huntington Garden, which is in California, it has many gardens within it, but it has the most beautiful Asian garden. And when I was there was this amazing stand of bamboo. And as I walked along, I saw that people had scarred it. They had taken out their jackknives or penknives, and they had put their initials or written things into the very large these were, of course, large stands of bamboo, so it was big enough to carve into like a tree. And it made me, it was desecration, it upset me. So I wrote a lot of raving poems first, a lot of angry things, and then it finally became this poem. Bamboo Grove, Huntington Garden, California. The swath they've incised runs 4 feet deep. When wind blows, crowds of initials click and court in the grove. Place of garden lovers, also the turf of Wanda and Richie. Jack and Stacy forever, spot where John loves Tom. No one's taught them bamboo's 1,400 uses, nor that some species take 30 years to bloom, some 100. Asian myth reveals that man sprang from the hollow internode, but the story hasn't reached them. They're an army of jackknives. The satin-skinned, the restless, would they not be better off, schooled about all the dreadful uses someone waits to put them to? No one's here, though I envision them indolently carving. Someone, risking scorn and shrugs, might tell them what Issa said. Rare luck it is indeed to be born in human form. I am a stranger passing through, arrested by their work. The bamboo ripples, parts its scars to bear the place where none have touched. Wind again. Who bows first, myself or the bamboo? Who at this moment can divide one survivor from the others?
That was great. That's a great environmentalist poem, really. It really is. It's one of those gentle poems that has a lot of meaning in it. I love the way you give nature feelings and thoughts, and only poets seem to do that.
Yeah.
It's really very interesting. So you're affected by the environment, obviously. Are you an environmental activist as well as somebody writing about it?
I suppose I am in my way. I mean, I'm a passionate lover of birds, and I'm a pariah among my friends because I keep my cat indoors, because actually the cat population of the United States has killed so many of our native birds. It's a number that you have to read it. It boggles the mind, and most people would probably say, this cannot be true.
Yeah.
But in fact, it is.
It is true, too, and we keep our cats inside as well.
Oh, so
and I understand how the songbirds are being decimated.
You're one of the rare ones, then.
And the neighbors think it's not natural, but, you know.
But I say then you have to choose, and then I say, is your domestic cat, who does not fit into the natural world, the cat is an add-on, you know, it has lived domestically with people for years. It doesn't belong in the wild world, not our domestic cat.
Yeah,
cats can go feral, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do. And then you write about cats, too. So it's a full circle. It's in your work. It's in our world.
And then the big cats, of course, they're very concerned with their own pets, but I feel no one cares enough about our big cats, our tigers and ocelots and panthers, all of these fantastic species that we will lose unless we care more.
Yeah.
And unless we try to educate our young people.
Absolutely. And this is a good way of doing it with poetry.
This poem was my turning towards saying, so who will help the young people? And, someone has to work with them. This narrator is, I think, interesting because in a way they confess then I am a stranger and passing through. So there's no chance for them to work with these young people who are scarring up this bamboo and thinking that it's the thing to do, that you just put your mark on whatever you pass through.
Yeah. Well, before we run out of time, Margot, I do want to have you read one more poem.
Okay.
This one's called Azure, and it's obviously from the collection Scanning for Tigers.
The azure is a very small, very beautiful blue butterfly that you can usually see right here upstate in the spring. Always an event. They're not as butterfly populations also are in trouble. This one is not as common as it used to be. Azure. The sky hides a puzzle. You must be a missing bit, dropped by heaven hand to beguile and lead me astray. Where are we going? White violet, you say. Why haven't I lived my life riveted to your flutter? You beat as if you knew my heart by heart. Memorized every second that ever gave me joy. Where are we going? Old field cinquefoil, you answer. Yellow, 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 calls a bird, intimate with the plan. You rise, dip toward shoreline where sea enfolds sky. The jut of coast cuffed with stone and sleeved by wild flag in bloom. Was there a thing called winter? Sorrow kite, break string and fly. I am an iris among irises, lofting into butterfly, and we are firmly under sail, and I have left 2 feet ashore. Farewell, faithful servants who carried me thus far.
That's great. That's great. We're almost out of time. Can you talk to us a little bit about it? What are you working on now? You got a new book up your sleeve?
A new collection, which is already, it's that odd thing, the poems, some of them are, of course, some are freshly new and others already feel like they have a long beard on them. They've uh-huh. been kicking around and you send them out and uh-huh. hope they find a home somewhere. And also, I'm working on some essays about writers, both writers that everyone knows, writers of large reputation, and also of writers that, well, a couple of poets that I knew who are dead now, and I wanted them to be remembered, and maybe this is the only way. So I have written essays about them. Uh-huh. One was a poet named Barbara Holland, who was a poet of the West Village, and known somewhat in her day, and a very fine, unusual, original poet. On the other, a man who worked in a poetry program I read who probably no one remembers now, but I remember him, Richard Davidson. And that's so great. I want to put him forth also.
Oh, how nice. How nice to be doing something like that. Now, do you have any contact information you can give people?
There is a website which is not a good one now. It is about to undergo some change. So they will see an ancient thing that was made
for edited work.
Yes, www.margofarrington.com. But that one, in a couple of months, will be a new one. My book, Scanning for Tigers, is available on Amazon. So,
great.
And for those who really wish to find, there's always a way to seek out that author that you want to commune with.
Absolutely. People are out there. Well, Margot Farrington, thank you so much for joining us. Again, her book is called Scanning for Tigers. It's her latest collection in poetry. Go out and get it. It's really a fascinating tour through somebody's mind and our culture. Thank you so much, Margot.
Thank you, Tish, very much.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.